Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston and PRI, it's Here and Now. I'm Jane Clayson. Coming up, the oil cap on the BP well is kept shut, even though there's a mysterious substance coming out near the ruptured well. We'll have the latest. Also, the immigration law of 1965. How different is public opinion today? And the local food movement. Why it's important beyond the environmental impact.
We have basically outsourced every facet of our day-to-day well-being. And really, food is one of the few things that we really have the possibility and the potential to do for ourselves.
These stories and more are coming up Here and Now.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Jane Clayson in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Despite a mysterious seepage from the seabed that could signal further damage to the BP oil well, the federal government is allowing the valves on the well's new cap to remain shut for another 24 hours. The extension was granted in return for BP's promise to step up monitoring of the surrounding seabed, as well as what could be methane gas leaking out of the well. Joining us is Henry Fountain of the New York Times. Henry, describe what is known about this seepage, where it's coming from, and what it might be.
Well, it's just been described as a seep, and there's not that much information about it. They've said that it's some distance from the well, but they haven't said how far it is from the well. Now, there are seeps in the ocean, all over the oceans, and there's a lot of seeps in the Gulf of Mexico. What they are natural spots where oil or gas or both come up through the rock and through the seabed. So in this case, it could be a natural seep like that, or it could be the well has been damaged in some way, and oil and gas are escaping from the well and then migrating up through the rock and up through the seabed. If we knew how far away it was from the well, we might have a better idea whether it's a natural seep or whether it's indication of a problem, but they haven't been very forthcoming about where it is or even really what it is.
Henry, what about the fear of methane gas, that it might be coming out of the well, and what are the complications that that could pose?
Well, that's the same sort of thing. It would be an indication of some sort of damage to the well, and so the gas is escaping outside of it and coming up into the water. BP reported that there were some gas bubbles coming up from around the well, but they thought that that was fairly common. They didn't think it was a sign of a problem. The Coast Guard has used the word methane, so again, it's a little unclear, but yes, if there were methane, that would be a sign that it was a problem. I think, you know, we would see if the decision was made after looking at all this, that there was a big problem with the well, they'd be reopening those valves you talked about, and they'd be restarting collection. That hasn't happened yet. The pressure readings they got when they did this test were fairly decent. They weren't at the level that would suggest that there was a lot of damage in the well, and they've actually been still rising very slowly throughout this test. If there was really a big problem, the pressure would be dropping rather quickly because the well would be basically open and oil and gas would be flowing out of it.
Can you talk more about the pressure readings for the new cap? We know that BP was hoping to see 8,000 or 9,000 pounds per square inch, but readings have fallen well short of that.
Well, they sort of modified it. They said that in a perfect world, the pressure would have risen above 7,500 pounds per square inch. Pressure rose to 6,700, and I think it's now at about 6,780. Which is not quite what they'd like, but it's really above the level at which they would have said, oh, we've got a big problem here. And it also rose in a fashion that's consistent with the well being in pretty good shape. It rose rather quickly at first, and then it's slowed down over time. So all those are good signs. Obviously, if there's a seep that's related to the well and if there's methane gas coming out, those are not good signs.
And so Admiral Thad Allen says the cap's valves can stay closed for another 24 hours. That's as of last night. I suppose we may see another extension tonight?
We may. I think they're just taking it day by day. BP said yesterday they would really love to keep this thing closed until the relief well is finished and they've finally killed the well once and for all. If at some point they decide to open it up, then they start collecting on these surface ships. Now, BP is saying that would require probably opening the valves before the surface ships were ready. There'd probably be some oil, more oil spewing into the Gulf. It's unclear exactly how long, and it's not really clear to me why that would have to happen. That's one of the questions I'm trying to ask BP.
You write about in your piece today that if the well is not reopened, it could mean that the precise volume of oil that has leaked may never be known, which raises serious questions about whether the company might escape some liability for the spill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if they have to reopen it and collect it, and they say once they have three or four surface ships around, they should be able to collect it all, well, then, you know, we would know how much they collected per day at this point. If they don't have to do that, we've never had an accurate measurement of the flow. We've had estimates, you know, pretty well-formed estimates by teams of scientists, but still, even that, the latest estimate is a range of 35,000 to 60,000 barrels a day, which is quite a range. So without, like, basically some precise measurement by actually, you know, filling up collection boats, you're not going to ever know that precise amount, and that does have an impact. You know, BP faces civil fines of something up to $4,000 a barrel. So if you don't know whether it's 100 million gallons or whatever that is, 25 million barrels or 10 million barrels or 5 million barrels or whatever, it's hard to figure out what those fines should be.
New York Times reporter Henry Fountain, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now to Hardwick, Vermont, a town of 3,200 people. It's having its 15 minutes of fame again. It's a mecca for foodies. Emeril Lagasse of TV fame went to film there. The town's even been featured in the food section of the New York Times. Hardwick was once famed for its granite. That ended in the 1920s when builders switched to concrete, and Hardwick fell on hard times. Behind today's boom are entrepreneurs growing local, sustainable, organic food. But often it's food that the locals cannot afford, says Vermont farmer and freelance journalist Ben Hewitt. Hewitt has written about the hope and the ironies in his new book, The Town Food Saved, How One Community Found Vitality in Local Food. He joins me now from Cliff House Audio, a studio in nearby Montpelier, Vermont. Ben, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me, Jane.
The media has labeled Hardwick, Vermont as the small town that goes from rags to riches with this so-called local food movement. But you see a more complex reality. Start by telling us about Hardwick, where exactly it is and what it looks like.
Hardwick is located in right at the gateway to the Northeast Kingdom, which is the most rural region in the rural state of Vermont. You know, it's got about a one-and-a-half block downtown with a slightly longer sort of business district, all the trimmings and fixings of a very sort of rural, land-based economy. During the first few years of its operation, the Buffalo Mountain Food Co-op, which opened in 1975, operated in the same building as a gun shop and a liquor store. And I sort of like to call that, you know, one-shop stopping Hardwick style. You could go into the same building and get your tofu, your Jim Beam, and your 357 Magnum.
You actually found that Hardwick's history, the social and civic infrastructure that it inherited, was crucial to what's happening today. So tell us what's happening today. This is the core, obviously, of your book.
You know, I was really became really struck about 4 or 5 years ago when I started to notice this incredible sort of growth and influx of small-scale ag-based businesses in the Hardwick area. And, you know, being a native Vermonter and having sort of grown up, socialized to this idea that Hardwick was a sort of, you know, hard times town, I became really struck by what I saw as this kind of wonderful, delicious irony in the juxtaposition between this reputation and this notion that this was the town that was sort of, you know, being held up as the savior of our food system and the, you know, this bastion of local food. I had always sort of been struck, you know, growing up in rural Vermont in a blue-collar community, it always had sort of seemed to me that the local food movement, you know, carried this sort of whiff of elitism and, you know, it was all about sort of organic free-range arugula and all these really high-end foods. And I just loved the notion that this town was perhaps the one that was going to, you know, show the rest of this country and perhaps even other countries, you know, how to create these localized food systems that are actually, you know, equitable and that work for everybody.
In fact, you made up a word for the people who are turning Hardwick around, the so-called saviors of the food system, as you say. You call them agripreneurs. Who are they and how did they transform Hardwick?
There's Tom Stearns. He operates, founded and operates a business called High Mowing Organic Seeds. There's Andrew Meyer. Andrew founded and owns two ag-based businesses in town. One is Vermont Soy, and the other is Vermont Natural Coatings, which takes whey from the cheese process, which would normally be a waste product, and turns it into environmentally friendly wood finishes. There is Pete Johnson, who operates Pete's Greens. They cultivate about 30 acres of certified organic vegetables.
Pete's the farmer hunk, as you call him.
Yeah, Pete is the farmer hunk. And when Pete Johnson's name comes up, you see a lot of swooning among the female members of the audience. And there's Andy and Matteo Keeler, and they operate two distinct businesses, but both based around the production of artisanal cheese. There's Tom Gilbert of the Highfield Center for Composting. They're all producing, you know, great products.
So there's a lot of good here, and you admire what these agripreneurs are doing up there, but you also see an irony. You're not really nourishing the region if you're selling, say, $20 hunk of cheese in a town where many people come home with a weekly paycheck of $300.
I think that's true. I mean, you know, one of the things that I thought about a lot was, how do we want to look at these food systems? And yes, these goods are perhaps beyond the means of many of the people in the region, but I think there's also something to be said for the fact that they are creating jobs that, by and large, have been very resilient to the broader economic malaise in this country and are, you know, pretty pleasant jobs that pay pretty good wages. That said, you know, the ultimate measure of success in any localized food system will be, can it really be viable from a business perspective and also be feeding the local populace? And, you know, in that regard, I think there's still plenty of work to be done in Hardwick and in any other towns where these efforts are going on.
Well, exactly right, because you spoke with a lot of longtime residents there who really have mixed feelings about this movement or are really not even aware that it exists.
Yeah, that's true. And I think, you know, the agripreneurs are 30-somethings. They're young and ambitious. And, you know, a lot of the sort of longtime farmers in the region, I mean, I talked to dairy farmers. I talked to a couple in their 60s that runs a mobile slaughter business and has done this for decades. They really were pretty much completely unaware of what was going on. And some of the other people are, I think, just a little leery of this. And they see that, you know, for generations, their families have been quietly operating on a localized sort of barter slash food economy. And I think they, for one, wonder what the heck all the fuss is about. And for another, perhaps feel a little bit threatened by the idea of Hardwick sort of being held up as the bastion of local food and are concerned by what might come with that. As these operations perhaps start to grow and need to expand their land base, and how might that threaten some of the farmers who have, you know, long been operating in the area on a much smaller or more quiet scale, I should say, and perhaps don't have the resources to sort of tie up some of those lands for themselves.
Put this conversation into perspective for us, into context for us, and tell us why you think this movement matters. Because obviously the local food movement is happening in other places. People like, you know, Michael Pollan and Barbara Kingsolver have written about it. But what has Hardwick taught you, and how has it taught you to think about food and farming differently?
That's a great question. And, you know, I've thought about this a lot. And I sort of, you know, I went into this book thinking that we need to move toward these local food systems for all sorts of sort of negative reasons. You know, the industrial food system is predatory on our land base. It's predatory on our environment. It's not sustainable, et cetera, et cetera. This is true. And we are going to have to figure out how to change the way we feed ourselves. But what I really came to was sort of this feeling of empowerment, I think, that comes from this. And, you know, not to sound too sort of groovy here, but I think as a culture, we have basically outsourced every facet of our day-to-day well-being. You know, we get up in the morning and, you know, we slip into clothes that we don't have any idea how to make. We live in houses that most of us don't know how to build, built out of materials that we wouldn't really know how to source, you know, if we wanted to. Mm-hmm. We drive cars we don't know how to fix. We use computers that we know nothing about that come from very, very far away. And really, food is one of the few things that we really have the possibility and the potential to sort of do for ourselves. And I think there's an incredible sense of empowerment that comes from that.
We're speaking with Vermont farmer and freelance journalist Ben Hewitt about the town of Hardwick, which is becoming a model for the local food movement. You can read an excerpt from his book, The Town Food Saved, about how businesses like Jasper Hill Cheese and True Yogurt inundated the town of Hardwick, Vermont. When we come back, can sustainable farming feed all of us? Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking about the promise and the ironies of the burgeoning food scene, the local food scene that has brought celebrity and celebrities to the town of Hardwick, Vermont. With us is Vermont farmer and freelance journalist Ben Hewitt. His new book is The Town Food Saved, How One Community Found Vitality in Local Food. And he admits in the book that farming is very hard work. But he argues that in today's economic reality, many people are looking for something tangible, like dirt and animals. Ben, just before the break, you were making a case for why local agriculture is important. We want to know more about what kind of model Hardwick brings to the rest of the country. And the important question, what is the future of local farming that is sustainable? Is it possible to feed 300 million Americans that way?
That's a really great question and a really hard question. And I think, you know, the flip and easy answer is yes. I was born into a one-room or two-room cabin, I guess. Almost two rooms, room and a half maybe. And, you know, my folks were of that sort of back-to-the-land movement. You know, my dad was editing poetry anthologies and writing poetry and, you know, keeping a big garden. And we had no running water or electricity. And my mom was milking cows at a farm down the road. My wife and I, with our two sons, do operate a small farm. We have 40 acres, and we have cows for beef and milk. We do pigs and sheep and chickens and ducks. And my 8-year-old son, is raising turkeys this year. We endeavor to do a lot of barter and trade with our neighbors. We try to make sure that our food stays, you know, as close to home as possible. It's really important to us that it just sort of stays in our community. You know, that's we place a high value, I guess, on that sort of, you know, maintaining those relationships with our neighbors.
And so what's the biggest thing you've learned from living, working, and eating in Hardwick?
You know, I really came, as you can tell by the title of my book, The Town That Food Saved, you know, I sort of came into this story with the notion that Hardwick was a town that needed saving. And I think part of that was just having grown up on its periphery and sort of being socialized to this idea that the town was really a hard times town. And, you know, to a certain extent, that's really true. I mean, the economic numbers sort of bear that out. But what those numbers don't do a very good job of is sort of, you know, describing the interconnectedness of the community and the way people look out for one another and are resourceful and able to sort of care for themselves. And I think we need to sort of figure out ways to sort of reimagine prosperity in this country. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that the notion simply building up, a huge retirement fund and, you know, having a bunch of equity in your house is not as certain as it might have seemed just a few years ago. And I think in terms of, you know, sort of enduring wealth, we could learn a lot, you know, from Hardwick, not only for what it's doing in terms of food, but also for what, you know, the community really, really is and how the community works. And, sort of ironically, I think a lot of what's happening in Hardwick is sort of happening not in spite of the fact that it's an economically disadvantaged region, but kind of because of it. And I guess, you know, by that I mean that when we have a lot of money, we basically have a safety net, and we are able to buy our way out of situations, or we are able to sort of distance ourselves from other people in our community. And when you don't have a lot of money, you really learn to rely on your friends and neighbors. You know, it's really a codependent relationship, I guess, in the best sense of the word. And I think, you know, that a lot of what's happening in Hardwick, what's happened historically in Hardwick around agriculture, and what's happening now in Hardwick around agriculture, is really a product of the fact that it is a town that has struggled economically.
Well, Ben, thank you very much. It's
a
wonderful book, and we appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Jane.
That's Vermont farmer and freelance journalist Ben Hewitt. We've been talking to him about his new book, The Town Food Saved, How One Community Found Vitality in Local Food. It's about the promise and some of the problems of the local food movement in the town of Hardwick, Vermont, population 3,200. To see what it looks like and to read an excerpt, go to our website, hereandnow.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. On beaches along the Gulf of Mexico, biologists and volunteers have been busy moving sea turtle eggs to try to save them from the tens of millions of gallons of oil that have polluted the sea and the sand. It's a delicate operation. Scientists have to pick up the eggs at just the right stage in their development. The eggs cannot be jostled or tipped sideways, because if they are, they are destroyed. Then they're driven across Florida to the Kennedy Space Center, where the hatchlings emerge and are safely returned to the sea. Joining us on her cell phone from the beach is Dr. Robin Trindell, who oversees the Sea Turtle Management Program for the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. Dr. Trindell, tell us where you are and describe what it's like.
I am on the sandy beach at St. George Island, which is in the forgotten coast of Florida near the beginning of the Panhandle. And I see a beautiful white sandy beach with the Gulf waters, light green to darker blue, breaking on the shoreline.
Any oil in sight?
There is no oil in sight on this beach at this time.
And so the concern now is that there might be oil, and you need to save these turtle eggs now. Is that right?
The concern is that there could be oil, but also that the hatchlings will go offshore, and they will find the same currents and convergence zones that carry the oil out in the Gulf of Mexico. So the probability of the hatchlings encountering the oil is actually much greater out in the water than it is in the beach right now.
Dr. Trindell, you and your colleagues have determined that the best time to move these eggs is 10 to 15 days before they would normally hatch, primarily because it's now thought that what's called imprinting for sea turtles might take place while the hatchling is in the shell. Tell us exactly what is imprinting.
Imprinting is the process by which the embryo documents signs of the nesting beach on which it was placed originally by its mother. Several species of sea turtles have what's called natal homing, or they return to the beach where they incubated to lay their own nest. So we think that the cues that these animals use to figure out how to get back to that beach, we think those cues are set during part of the incubation process.
And they actually don't return for some 25 years. That's incredible.
It really is, and that's why we felt it was so important to get these eggs and to get them before the hatchlings could emerge.
So describe a nest for us, Dr. Trindell, and the eggs, and what precautions you have to take to pick up these most delicate eggs.
The nest itself is carefully constructed by the female. She'll come up the beach. She'll use her back flippers to dig a nest cavity, and then she'll start to deposit her eggs. And then she'll use her flippers to spray sand all around so it's not so obvious. We then have a group of specially trained individuals who go out, and you start by finding the clutch. And you do this by carefully moving the sand away from the area where she nested, and carefully digging down with your fingers. And at the same time, you have two styrofoam coolers that you've prepared. You've put a layer of 3 inches of insulating sand using sand from the nest. You then very carefully lift the eggs out of the ground using very small movements and slow, careful movements. You place that egg on top of the layer of sand. And if you twist or turn the egg too much, it would result in the death of the embryo.
So they're driven across Florida in FedEx trucks to a climate-controlled warehouse at Kennedy Space Center. How long will they be there?
Up to 10 days, at which time we'll get reports that they're beginning to see signs of hatchings in the cooler, which is very exciting.
I understand you've had one nest hatch so far. Do you consider that a victory?
Well, to be honest, this is such an intense manipulation of the nest. We feel it's always better to let nests develop and the animals hatch naturally, that we see this as the best possible compromise we could reach to try to protect these animals while allowing them, to the degree possible, to incubate and develop in their native beaches.
We're reading, Dr. Trindell, that only about 700 sea turtles have been affected by the oil spill. Seems like a low number to me. Does it seem low to you? How do you explain that?
That's the number we've found. It's always difficult when you're working in the offshore environment to actually find the animals that could have been affected. So I have no doubt that we are seeing only a small proportion of the animals that were likely affected by the oil.
Dr. Robin Trindell oversees the Sea Turtle Management Program for the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. Dr. Trindell, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Back in 30 seconds with a look back at immigration circa 1965. It's Here and Now. Welcome back. At the end of this month, Arizona's controversial new immigration law, known as SB 1070, will go into effect. The state will require police to verify the immigration status of those they stop. Detractors say the law promotes racial profiling and oversteps the state's power. Have race and the limits of state power always played a role in immigration policy? For some perspective, let's go back to 1965, when a law abolishing immigration quotas changed the face of modern America. Jack Chin is a professor at University of Arizona's Rogers College of Law, and he joins us from KUAZ in Tucson. Professor, tell us what immigration laws were like before 1965.
Basically, there was a white America policy from the beginning of the Republic. In 1790, the first Congress passed and George Washington signed a naturalization bill which limited the ability to become a naturalized citizen to free white persons, the law said. And from 1790 to 1952, there were racial restrictions on who could become a naturalized citizen. So federal law essentially established a race test for who would be a desirable member of society, one of the people of the United States. Immigration law, federal immigration law, really didn't get rolling until 1882. Up until then, most regulation of immigration was done by the states. And the Supreme Court declared that unconstitutional, and Congress was forced to step into the breach and pass some immigration laws. And the first ones they passed regulated the race of immigrants, the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. From 1882 to 1965, one of the primary goals of federal immigration policy was to limit the number of immigrants who were not racially, culturally congenial. The goal was to admit more white immigrants.
So to understand the immigration law of 1965, help us understand the political and the legal climate of that time, of 1965.
The Congress in office in 1965 was probably one of the most liberal in history. They had passed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, or the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which also changed the political landscape. And they had this idea that people's status in society and people's rights and roles should not be primarily determined by race. They should be determined by individual qualifications and individual merit. And so the immigration law in force before 1965 strictly limited the number of African immigrants. It strictly limited the number of Asian immigrants. And it preferred Northern and Eastern Europeans. And it discriminated also against Jews and Catholics from Southern Europe. And this became increasingly objectionable to many people. And the 1965 Immigration Act was the product. And basically, it eliminated the idea that members of a particular race, a particular religion, were desirable immigrants. Instead, it looked at the individual qualities that the immigrants had, such as connections to the United States or job skills.
And the common view was that the 1965 Act would not radically alter the demographic makeup of the United States, which, of course, was false. But you interviewed the participants of the acts, and I'm curious what they said about it.
My view is that people understood that there was going to be a change. I was in touch with President Ford, who was the minority leader in the House at the time, and he said it was anticipated that the 1965 amendments would substantially increase the number of Asian immigrants. As the Republican leader in the House of Representatives at the time, I favored that result. Peter Rodino, chair of the House Judiciary Committee, said that he thought at the time that the increase could be substantial. Adam Walensky, one of Robert Kennedy's lawyers in the Justice Department, he didn't mince any words. He told me, "You'd have to be a real dope not to know that the number would go up of immigrants from non-traditional sources." And the legislative history bore that out, what people were saying in Congress. The witnesses, the senators, the representatives, many of them said, "We understand that some regions of the world have been treated unfairly, that we've had a set of preferences for people of particular races, particular nations, and that's un-American, and we're going to stop."
And so how would you contrast the tone in 1965 to the tone today in 2010?
There's a long history of ebbing and flowing of immigration, of welcoming immigrants and resisting them. There's a pattern of immigration restriction in times of economic anxiety. When times are tough, there is often sentiment to limit the number of other people who come to the United States to work. 2010 strikes me as being pretty similar to what was going on in the early 1880s, what was going on after World War I and at other moments when immigration restriction was put in. It does seem to me that there was more confidence in 1965, much more confidence, that the United States was capable of welcoming and integrating immigrants into society. I think a lot of the people who supported getting rid of race as a part of American immigration policy did so because they thought that newcomers would learn English, would maintain some of their customs and traditions and cultural characteristics, but also the idea of the melting pot was very strong then, and they thought that immigrants would become part of the fabric of America. And I think that was true. Now, I think there's a little more suspicion that the melting pot doesn't work anymore.
Well, as you know, the fear with the Arizona law is that it will lead to racial profiling. And in a recent Washington Post op-ed piece, you uncovered a 1975 Supreme Court ruling that would seem to support that fear.
Yes. The Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court and the Arizona Supreme Court have both held that in the immigration context, race is a legitimate consideration. So apparent Mexican ancestry can be considered by the police in evaluating the question of whether someone is potentially undocumented. Immigration law recognizes that someone who is born in another country is possibly not a citizen. And so evidence that someone has these ties to another country can be taken into account, said the United States Supreme Court and the Arizona Supreme Court. So, and SB 1070, the law says that law enforcement officers and agencies may not consider race, color, or national origin except as permitted by the U.S. or Arizona Constitution. So the SB 1070 specifically refers to these cases saying that race can be a permissible factor and brings them into SB 1070. So yes, it seems to me that SB 1070 is designed to take into account race in enforcing these laws.
That's Jack Chin, professor at University of Arizona's Rogers College of Law. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Foundling, foundling, looking for home, wanders through darkness and travels alone.
That's The Foundling, the title song on the latest CD by Mary Gaucher, and the foundation of a song cycle Mary wrote when she found the woman who had given her up for adoption.
A baby unwanted, unloved and unblessed, left on a doorstep and unbidden guest.
Mary Gaucher joins us from the studios of Spotland Productions in the place she now calls home, Nashville, Tennessee. Mary, welcome to Here and Now.
It's such a pleasure to be with you, Jane. Thanks for having me.
The Foundling is a collection of songs that had been in your head and in your heart for many years. And I want to start at the beginning here, which takes us to St. Vincent's Women and Infants Asylum on Magazine Street in New Orleans in 1962. Can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, on the day I was born, my mother left me at the orphanage because she was an unmarried single woman in the early 60s, and there was an awful lot of shame associated with being pregnant and unmarried back then. She was told that there was a family that could take care of me better than her. And so I was born, she held me for a few minutes, then that was it. I never saw her again.
You write about that feeling of being left on the doorstep by your birth mother in this song called Mama Here, Mama Gone. Let's listen.
Cut loose and falling through the crevice, cradle crack. Rock-a-bye, baby. Mama ain't coming back. This night has no ending. darkness, no dawn, descending, descending, Mama here, Mama gone.
About a year after arriving at St. Vincent's, you were adopted by a couple. And raised in Baton Rouge, it wasn't a terribly happy childhood. Your father was an alcoholic. At 15, you stole a car, you left home, you got into drugs, got into some trouble, spent your 18th birthday in a jail cell in Salina, Kansas, and your life was headed down a pretty rough road. How did you manage to turn it around?
I managed to get sober when I was 29 years old, and have been sober ever since.
When you got sober, the musical floodgates opened, didn't they? The songwriting began.
The songs started coming almost immediately after I put down the alcohol and the drugs, and they're still coming. It's been a while now, and it's a focus that I acquired after sobriety that allowed me to become an artist.
Your music has won many awards and critical acclaim. You've been compared to Lucinda Williams and Johnny Cash, but none of your songs are about the most significant thing in your life, your adoption. That all changes when a music tour takes you back to New Orleans and you make a pilgrimage to St. Vincent's Orphanage.
I don't even know how to explain the crashing down of denial. It's impossible to put into words, but it all became real when I saw the pictures of orphans on the walls, and I started looking in the pictures to see if I was there, and I felt some compassion and empathy for my birth mother, the fear she must have experienced in that place, that haunted, most haunted place. And that's when the muse started talking to me and telling me I needed to write a concept record about this.
You also hired somebody to find your birth mother, and it took you 6 months to work up the courage to finally call her.
Yeah, it took 3 days to find her and 6 months to call her.
What did you say?
I walked around that phone for 6 months and then 4 hours during the day I was going to call her. I just walked around it and around it and around it, pacing, 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 trying to figure it out. And finally I realized the way that I could do it is if I called her and thanked her. Instead of looking for something, if I came to the table with something to give, I could make the call. So I called her, and I just wanted to thank her for the sacrifice she made and for giving me the gift of life. And I called her, and that's what I did. I thanked her.
Out of that conversation was born your song, March 11th, 1962. It's the day your birth mother left you at the orphanage. I want to listen to that.
Hello, this is Mary. March 11th. It took me $500 and 40 years to find you. I know it's almost Christmas. I don't mean to make you cry. Now you ask me why I'm calling. I don't know why.
Mary, what was it like writing that song and furthermore playing it for the first time?
I performed it a couple of weeks ago with a huge band, and when the drummer cracked the stick on that snare drum at the end of that song, I thought my knees were going to come out from under me. There's something about when he hit that note, it all became more real than it ever has been.
You say that I'm a secret, nobody knows, and you can't talk.
Do you ever think about or fantasize about your birth mother hearing these songs and what she might say about them?
No, because I don't think she will hear these songs, and I don't think she would understand if she did hear these songs. But I think there are other birth mothers out there who are listening who will hear them and understand, and other adoptees, and people who have similar emotional experiences, if not literally similar experiences, and they understand.
Look, I know we're strangers, but we might just hurt the same. I'm not looking for I'm sorry. I'm not looking to lay blame. I guess guess I had to thank you once before this life went by. Yeah, that's why I called. Goodbye.
Another song that came out of your pilgrimage back to St. Vincent's Orphanage is called The Orphan King. And it's kind of a defiant statement, perhaps something of an answer to your mother's refusal to speak with you?
Yeah, it is. It's a strong statement. The idea behind the song is that I believe in love, and even though it's been a struggle to get the maternal love that I so craved, it's not taken away my faith in love itself.
Hail the orphan king with a crooked smile and a crackerjack ring, an alley cat chord and a song to sing. I still live.
Mary Gaucher's CD is called The Foundling. Mary, thank you very much.
I'm grateful for the opportunity to play it. Thank you.
You don't know alone till you sit on a throne, but I still believe in love.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Jane Clayson. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.